Support for WKAR is provided by the Lansing Regional Chamber of Commerce, supporting more than 1,100 businesses in the greater Lansing area for more than 110 years. Information at lansingchamber.org. And by MSU Federal Credit Union, providing credit union members with 24-hour account access online and now on your mobile internet, insured by NCUA.
It's Current State on 90.5 WKAR. While the U.S. Senate passes an immigration bill that includes a pathway to citizenship, as well as $48 billion assigned to increased border enforcement. There is the bargain that needed to be made, and now the onus is on the House of Representatives. What kind of bill does the House come up with specifically? Are there enough measures dealing with border security that the House could put into the bill to compensate for the citizenship provisions that also need to be there that will generate enough Republican support to pass the House? That is the question. And you think John Boehner has been in the catbird seat before? Where is he going to come down on this? This is going to be very interesting to watch. Later this hour for Friday on Current State, we look at the history of African Americans in rural Michigan, not urban Michigan, but rural Michigan. Also, the College of Communication Arts and Sciences here at MSU is launching a weather balloon. They're affixing cameras to it and so they can get footage of the earth from as high as 100,000 feet off the ground. That is where you can start to notice the curvature of the earth. And there isn't a whole lot of movie video footage that they can play with that has that footage in it. So MSU Comm Arts and Sciences to the rescue. We'll talk with Troy Hale later on this hour. But first, every last Friday of the month, Current State looks back on Michigan news stories that continue to resonate. A lot has happened this month.
Take a vote, not a vacation.
For those who don't support the direction the federal government is headed, there is a difference in philosophy or a difference in strategy.
What is happening with the cost of the auto insurance is really hurting our economic recovery in Michigan.
The only people who are going to win in this one is going to be the insurance companies.
Irrespective of the science behind it, the legislature, they were hell-bent on creating this wolf hunt.
And unless there is new and more relevant information that comes forward, the likelihood is that I will still be voting no on this.
In order to get people out of their cars, you've got to be able to provide enough frequency for them to be able to want to use the service.
Marriage is between one man and one woman. It's what's best for children. It's what's best for society.
Momentum is just going to continue to build. We are ready to achieve full equality under the law.
Here for Current State's Month in Review segment, weighing in on Medicaid expansion, the road ahead for marriage equality in Michigan, Common Core, the city of Detroit, all of those stories with legs, the host of WKAR-TV's Off the Record, Tim Skubick. Hi, Tim.
Morning. How you doing, Marky?
Real well. Jonathan Osting of MLive, nice to see you.
Likewise.
And Emily Lawler of the Michigan Information and Research Service, that's MERS.
Thanks.
Hi, Emily.
Thanks for having me.
Arguably the biggest story of the month in Michigan was the Senate's inaction on Medicaid expansion. It's not often we see Governor Rick Snyder looking terribly disapproving, but he certainly did look that way when he uttered words that will ring in our ears for a while. Here is the governor, fresh off his sudden return to Lansing from Israel for a bout of arm twisting.
A majority of the House of Representatives supports Healthy Michigan. I, as governor, support Healthy Michigan. I believe there's actually most likely a majority in the Senate that supports Healthy Michigan. But if it doesn't come to a vote, it doesn't get done. That's not the right answer for Michigan. And my understanding is they're going to recess and leave. That's not right. Take a vote, not a vacation.
Let's make some sense out of the current landscape here for us. The governor declined to order the Senate back, but he's still stumping for expansion, and a work group is holding meetings. Tim Skubick, what does this all add up to?
Well, there's been some major developments this morning. We just came out of the studio with Randy Richardville, and here's the poop. There, can you say that on public radio?
You can say that one.
Okay, I just did. There will be a committee vote, Mr. Richardville says, sometime in July to move this legislation if they can come to an agreement. He says there will be a vote he plans in August to pass something. He met with the governor yesterday in a very intense half-hour meeting where it became clear that the governor would drop from his lexicon the word vacation. Senators did not like that. And so that, and there will be no robocalls, and there will be no billboards. And so there's a bit of peace is at hand here between Mr. Richardville and the governor. They're not there yet. Mr. Richardville also announced that he will likely be adding two or three Democrats to the work group that was formed this week that was all Republicans. So that is movement. That's as a result of his conversation with this morning with Gretchen Whitmer, the Senate Democratic leader. She made the request. He says it's likely he will honor it. So the passion of the past week, which is still a great story, we all agree, okay, and was fun to cover, that appears to be moving on now. I said, Mr. Richard, are you and the governor on the same page? He said, yep. We are in the same book. Take that and mean that as you so choose.
Can we infer anything about what's in the measure from your encounter?
They don't know, and that's what they're working on. Okay, the waivers need to be in the package, they said, but they're very concerned about what happens if the feds bail out on the state. The Republican speaker has said the program will end. Mr. Richardville says we don't believe that. And so that's one of the issues that they're going to work on. So it looks, he says, we're on a path. We're on a path, which is where the process is supposed to be.
Emily Lawler, any response to that development?
Yeah, I think that the Senate's going to want to put their own spin or touch on these bills. The House version, the governor's office had worked really closely with the House to come up with what they came up with. And I think that the Senate didn't take a vote on it because they just weren't sure. The administration hadn't been working as closely with the Senate, it appears, as they were with the House. And I think that the Senate has some room to make changes before they take a vote.
Politically, the Senate's inaction on Medicaid expansion underscored philosophical differences between centrist Republicans like the governor and more conservative Republicans. Could the governor's support of Medicaid expansion help repair any of the damage he sustained over right to work or taxing pensions or anything like that? Jonathan Osting, any thoughts on that?
Well, I certainly think there's a segment in the in the middle of the political spectrum that's going to appreciate the governor's push, especially if he is able to succeed with the push. That's the big question, whether that will happen. It's certainly not helping him any with the Tea Party, of course, which wasn't a huge fan of his to begin with. And it looks like his support for right to work didn't necessarily spell long-term support from them either.
Tim Skubick, we're lucky to have you right on the heels of shooting Off the Record. Anything else you can share with us regarding that you're willing to share with us?
No, I'm all about transparency. Isn't that the code word in town? Look, this was a very tense exchange. Mr. Richardville said that he thought it was a learning experience for the governor. All the governors that I've covered, some of them incorrectly assume that their leader in the legislature is their leader and please carry the water for me. And most of the time they do. Richardville has been very cooperative with this governor. They've had their disagreements. But at the end of the day, as Mr. Richardville points out, the caucus elected me, not the governor. And so his bottom line loyalty is to the caucus. And his guys and ladies were simply telling him we're not ready to move. In fact, he told the governor not to come back from Israel. Because nothing was going to happen.
Wow.
And Richardville believes that the governor's staff gave him more optimistic information than was accurate on the vote and the head count. So he basically said, stay in Israel, have a couple more bagels, and come back when you're ready, and we'll work on this thing. But the governor came back with the anticipation that all he had to do was show up and say, here I am, guys, let's do this. And guess what? It didn't. So and the D's are going to make hay on this. They're going to say this was a lack of leadership on his part, and it's something that they will bang the governor over the head on, and I think he knows he's going to get that.
We've got a Republican Medicaid expansion proposal that's been put into play by Senator Patrick Colbert. Help me with the last name here, from Hillsdale County, I believe.
No, it's Caswell.
Caswell.
Caswell. There we go. Does this development bode well for Senator Caswell's legislation, or do we know?
We do. Richard Veal said it's probably a non-starter.
But
they will look at it because there might be elements in it. I'm sorry to take away your question.
No, that's okay.
Okay.
That's okay. Gay rights supporters in Michigan and all across the country are celebrating two Supreme Court rulings from Wednesday on DOMA and on gay marriage in California. These developments have equal rights advocates very upbeat and confident. Here is Emily Devendorf 24 hours ago here on Current State talking about the high court's rulings.
That is not something that is going to move backwards. That is something that is only going to keep moving forward. So certainly whether we got bad news yesterday or even better news, there's enough work to be done still that we are just going to keep moving forward. And the base is really just building, and more people are coming to our side every day so that Gary's friends tend to be the outliers on this issue at this point.
She was referring to Gary Glenn, who was on the telephone at the same time. Jonathan Osting, what kind of response at the Capitol or in downtown Lansing have Wednesday's rulings triggered? What are people saying?
Well, Democrats are certainly excited about it. They view it as another form of momentum. They've introduced legislation to overturn the state's ban on same-sex marriage. Republicans, however, probably unlikely to take that up. There is some movement in terms of the Elliot Larson Civil Rights Act. Republicans are saying that they'd be willing to consider updating that law. But I don't think we're going to see any moves legislatively on Michigan's same-sex marriage ban. It's probably going to end up in the courts or on the ballot in 2016.
Emily, what are you hearing about the impact these rulings are likely to have on the gay marriage ban? Is the gay marriage ban's days numbered?
You know, it's interesting because there's a pending court case in Wayne County right now, a federal court case, that the judge wanted to see these Supreme Court rulings before he decided what to do. And he's deciding the question of whether Michigan's ballot initiative ban or constitutional ban on gay marriage is legal or not.
This is Judge Friedman?
Yep. Yeah. So he's got some reading to do, I'm assuming, of the Supreme Court opinions, and he could strike down Michigan's ban on gay marriage at that level. So there could be some legal implications.
Is a ballot proposal the most likely road ahead, Tim Skubick?
I don't think there's any question about it. I think we're headed for, they say, don't mix politics and religion. Stand by, sport fans. This one's going to be very interesting. Catholic Church already lining up, denouncing the Supreme Court decision and suggesting that if indeed there is a petition drive, that they will mount a campaign to make sure if it gets on the ballot that it will be defeated, that, quote, the status quo is kept. That's from Paul Long, who's the head of the Michigan Catholic Conference. And then Ms. Devendorf basically is equally passionate about raising $12 million to collect the signatures to get a yes vote on this thing. So I think we're headed for a showdown in 2016.
Well, the left is clearly energized and confident. Some sources, I think, Tim, we're thinking about the same sources here, claim that by November 2016, support for marriage equality in Michigan could top 60%. But could the rulings re-energize the right as well? Emily, any thoughts?
You know, I'm not sure that it will. This may be one of those issues that people just aren't jazzed up about anymore. I mean, it's not politically correct. We saw a huge backlash against Dave Ejima when he posted anti-gay comments on Facebook, and I'm just not sure that there's as much of a forum or a venue for anti-gay marriage views as there used to be. So whether or not anyone will be motivated to create that forum, I guess we'll see with this ballot drive who puts money into it or against it.
Attorney General Bill Schuette's resistance or support of the gay marriage ban in Michigan plays into this as well, though, because Mr. Glenn told us yesterday on Current State he knows that the Attorney General will take this all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court if necessary.
Sure, the Attorney General did file a brief, actually, in the California case that was before the Supreme Court. He's also filed a brief in the federal case in Detroit, defending Michigan's law. As he says, it's not a discriminatory policy, but an affirmation of traditional marriage. So he's certainly going to keep the fight alive.
Mark, this is a bit of a conundrum for this governor.
You picked exactly where I was going to go next.
I can actually read upside down. I'm a journalist. You know what I'm saying?
Nice.
What does this guy do?
Exactly.
Right now, what he's doing is nothing. I got in the news car. And when this decision popped, I said, I got to talk to this guy. So we went down to Battle Creek, okay? And so, Governor, what do you think of this decision? Well, I haven't read it yet, and I know where this is going to go. Okay, but you got to ask him the questions. And basically, after a minute and a half, he gave me absolutely nothing. He said, I'm not wading in to the middle of a federal lawsuit, and I'm staying focused on healthy Michigan and jobs. But here's his problem. I know he doesn't want to offend the conservative base, but in a general election where the electorate, if the polls are correct, and Mr. Glenn is not sure that they are, but let's assume that they are, independent voters and moderates might be more on board.
Absolutely.
And so the governor, what does he do?
Exactly.
Does he play to them? Does he keep his mouth shut and potentially lose them? You know what? I bet you he gets a lot of heat back in Ann Arbor on this issue.
Sure.
I know they were not happy with him when he vetoed the health care benefits for folks at the university. He said that was a fiscal decision, but a lot of people in Ann Arbor said, no, it was a social decision, and we can read the tea leaves, Governor. So this is a problem for him. It's not a deal breaker, but it's interesting to watch how he handles it. And so far, he's saying nada.
He has been able to sidestep a lot of hot-button social issues. He is averse to taking positions
He's the best I've ever seen.
He's kind of a technocrat. He is a guy who's a pragmatic technocrat.
He's a career politician.
But that moves the timeline up as well. We've been focused on November 2016 and a ballot reversal. The election for the governor is November 2014. Yeah. That moves it up.
Let me correct that. He's acting like a career politician. Okay. He would take umbrage to the fact of being described as a career politician.
The governor's logic on this is that he doesn't want to weigh into a federal issue, at least with the case before the Supreme Court. He's done that in a few instances with immigration.
But this is a state issue, isn't it?
Well, exactly. He said that he doesn't want to weigh in until it directly impacts Michigan. So if the Supreme Court ruling would have, he might have had an opinion on it then. But supporters are obviously making the case that this does have an impact on Michigan families, on Michigan gay couples, on the Michigan economy even, which is something that the governor certainly doesn't shy away from weighing in on.
And maybe once it is a ballot initiative, we saw him take positions on all six of the ballot initiatives last time around. So I would think that once voters are deciding, he would weigh in.
Oh, I want to hear that.
How many conservatives do you think might be led to reexamine their positions on gay marriage after the Supreme Court ruling?
No, the ones who are true believers will not.
But I think that there are some who are maybe looking for an excuse to, break from the party's not welcome stance.
Doesn't the Supreme Court decision, though, to almost by definition, get people to reexamine their positions?
I'm not so sure.
No, Skubic, no.
Reexamine, reaffirm the positions they already have. You can read into it what you want to read into it, I guess.
I want to jump into what you feel was the most underreported story of June. What didn't get enough exposure to daylight?
So the results of the Michigan Merit Exam came out this week. It's an exam given to all 11th graders and showed basically some very large achievement gaps between different demographics and different groups. Economically disadvantaged are performing, lower than the average. But also African-American students in this state are having a really hard time. There's something like 4% of them are proficient in science compared to 29% of students generally tested. So I think that the state's going to have to kind of address some gaps like that. How can we help our English language learners, our poor students, and our African American students catch up?
Someone on WKAR radio, I don't know if it was from NPR or if it was Rick Pluta or who it was, but they referred to the achievement gap as the civil rights issue of the 21st century.
And I believe it. I mean, honestly, when you look at some of these numbers, they're disturbing.
Jonathan Osting, underreported story of June?
Sure. Well, it got a little press when the Board of Canvassers certified the petitions, but right now there's a petition drive being organized by Right to Life of Michigan, which is basically seeking to bypass the governor's veto last year on legislation that would prohibit abortion coverage in insurance policies, both public and private. Those efforts are really ramping up this month and next month. Right to Life is going to have volunteers out at summer fairs, farmers markets. They're even talking to volunteers about how to seek signatures at their churches. So that's going to really ramp up this month.
Tim Skubith, the underreported story of June?
I got none. I thought long and hard last night. I thought of coming up here. I think we're all doing a great job.
Yeah, you've been doing too much reporting, Tim.
Yeah, but you can never do enough, right, Emily?
A few weeks ago, Governor Snyder signed a budget into law that did not include funding for adopting Common Core education standards. Again, the governor and other Republicans support them, but not enough. Where's the discussion on Common Core, Emily?
Honestly, I think that it's a policy issue that the people that oppose it seem to not understand very well. There's discussion about it being, you know, a big federal mandate, and it's not a federal mandate. It was started and signed on to by a bunch of individual states, and basically
Michigan was one of them.
Michigan was one of them. And, you know, for Michiganders, it's a question of, you know, if you move to another state, if you move to Ohio and your kid's in sixth grade, you have an assurance that they'll be on track. You know, when you move from Michigan to Ohio, they'll be at relatively the same place in the same curriculum. So without that assurance, yeah, you really can't protect your kids like that and know that they're going to be at the place you want them to be.
Jonathan, Common Core?
Yeah, it's essentially on pause right now. I mean, by inserting that language that prevents funding, that takes place in the next fiscal year. So really, they're going to come back to it, you know, this fall and potentially revisit the issue. So Common Core is certainly not dead in Michigan, but there's certainly a lot of opposition to
it. But are our minds being changed in the as we wait, though?
Yes, with this discussion right here, I just thought of an underreported story.
Let's take
a look at the groups that are supporting Common Core: transportation and Medicaid, chambers of commerce, business groups, traditionally in our town very strong. What have they got to show for their efforts? Zippo. They're being taken to the cleaners by people that oppose Common Core. Look, the business community says, we want to make sure, and educators are saying, the kid in Ontonagon gets the same education as the kid in Okemos. And they're suggesting this is a way to do it. But yet, all of these special interest groups, which have been very powerful in the past, have nothing to show for their support on these issues. I think that's been underreported, and it's actually an original thought for a Friday morning.
Dan Howes might have beaten you to that.
Oh, my gosh.
Dan Howes.
I guess I'll leave now.
In yesterday's Detroit News. Oh, definitely a related thought. He writes, quote, "The consensus for disciplined budgeting, tax reform, and business friendliness, hallmarks of Governor Rick Snyder's first 2 years, is giving way to an internecine battle between the governor and his own Republican Party that threatens to stall the comeback he so frequently touts. Roads, Medicaid expansion, Common Core curriculum standards, increased funding for higher education, all of it and more are getting mired in an ideological battle that mostly doesn't include the minority Democrats." If a comeback got started, is it stalled, and do conservative Republicans have to own that?
Well, look, it's not over yet, all right? We still have a couple more innings to go, and don't give up on this governor, because he is relentless, if anything else, and he usually gets his way, which was part of the problem in this debate over Medicaid. People were telling me privately, you know, he's not always going to get his way. You know, you just can't be the CEO and come and tell the legislature what to do, okay? So this is why there was a learning experience. But he's got plenty of time to snatch a victory from the jaws of defeat. It takes time. That's what the process is.
What are you working on right now, Emily? What are you looking at the next few days, few weeks?
You know, while the legislature's on break, I have some more time to dive into deeper level policy issues. So hopefully you'll be seeing some good stuff coming out.
Beach reading, probably.
And beach reading.
Jonathan, what are you working on?
Well, I am reporting on the petition drive, an update on where that stands with the abortion insurance issue. And also, I spent some time in the Capitol yesterday checking out the work that's being done there. And I'm going to have a story on kind of the historical implications of the new carpet and rewiring.
Very interesting. Tim Skubick, what are you going to be watching in July?
When the legislature's gone, this is a fun time. Because this is where you earn your keep. You actually have to make phone calls. We're going to have John Dingell on the show next week, and I'm following up on this Richardville stuff to try to get my arms around what's going to happen next.
Very good. We want to thank all of our guests: Tim Skubick, host of WKAR-TV's Off the Record, Jonathan Osting of MLive, and Emily Lawler of MERS. Thank you one and all. See you soon.
Thanks, Marty.
Thanks.
Coming up on the program, MSU launches a weather balloon to take pictures of space and the Earth. That is coming up on Current State. Stay with us. Welcome back to Current State. Reach us via email at currentstate@wkar.org. Later on this hour, we look at the history of African Americans in rural Michigan. Rural Michigan. We talk with an expert here coming up. This Sunday, a team of MSU undergraduate students from the College of Communication Arts and Sciences, along with engineering grad students, will launch a weather balloon affixed with five HD cameras and a GPS device. The launch, led by MSU instructor and filmmaker Troy Hale, will attempt to obtain video footage from the edge of space as the balloon is expected to rise to nearly 100,000 feet where the curvature of the Earth can be seen. And Troy Hale is here to tell us more, along with MSU student Eric Tobler, who's a senior studying media and information. Welcome to Current State, guys.
Thank you.
Tell us what you have planned for Sunday, Troy.
Well, it's a balloon launch. It's just for fun, really. A lot of my students, they like to make documentaries and things, so we're doing a behind-the-scenes documentary about this as well. And we plan to get out there. We're going out there on Saturday to actually build the balloon, and then Sunday we're going to go out there and we're going to launch it.
And give us kind of the timeline of when are you scheduled to send the thing up, and how long will it be up there?
We're going to launch about 10:30 in the morning from Grand Rapids. And we're expecting it to go between 1 and 4 hours for the flight. And we're going to be, underneath it with a real-time radio chasing it. So it could go up to about 60 miles from the launch site.
And up to 100,000 feet?
Yep.
So the real quick math tells me almost 20 miles.
Yes.
Above the planet.
Three times higher than you fly in a jet airliner.
Three times higher than a jet airliner. And where does the launch take place, and where do you expect the balloon to travel?
Well, we teamed up with a team in Grand Rapids, Intermet Systems, and they do this a lot. So they have a lot of expertise in this. So we're launching from their headquarters in Grand Rapids. It'll probably be about 4 hours, and we're kind of expecting it to land somewhere between Grand Rapids and Lansing.
Oh, okay. Okay. Eric Tobler, tell us what your involvement in this.
Well, my involvement is mostly on the filmmaking side of things.
You're filming the behind-the-scenes documentary then?
Okay. Yes. Okay. Yeah. And this is one of the biggest projects I've ever done, so pretty exciting.
How many cameras do you have to play with?
I'll be having two, and then I think we're going to have two other shooters this weekend, and they'll probably have two cameras, and then we have these five that are going to be on the balloon.
Yeah, we've got a little camera, a Hero 3. I have no idea how it works or what it's doing, but it looks like it's pointed at me and it's flashing.
Flashing. And
I don't know exactly how to feel about this. Should I smile?
You could smile. The nice thing is I've got my smartphone here, and I can turn it on from my smartphone. Okay. And it goes.
There we go.
So I can actually control this. So we're going to put five of these cameras inside the balloon. We're going to build them into the balloon, and then I can control them from my phone to turn them all on before we launch.
And they're static cameras, though. They're just going to see what they see. They're not on swivels really crazy like that.
Yeah, they're just going to see what they see, and we're going to have them strategically placed. So we're going to have three around in a circle. And then we're going to have one pointing up and one pointing down. So the idea of this is to try to get we're going to try to put this into a children's museum where kids can walk in and they can look all around and they can actually fly this balloon into space.
Okay. Sounds like Epcot Center at Disney World,
where you have
all kinds of experiential things like that going on. Are there any other applications for this?
The video aspect is going to be in our documentary, or in our behind the scenes kind of thing. We're also going to give it out to some of the media if they come and show up for this. So we'll get it on the news. It's always one of those fun things that, when you see a roller coaster ride on TV and you kind of sit there and you're in your seat at home and you're moving back and forth because you feel like you're riding on it. It's kind of one of those kind of experiences. We're never going to be able to be at that altitude. Unless you're an astronaut, you're not going to be able to be up there. So this is the closest way that we can actually experience what it's like up there.
And where is the museum that you have in mind for this?
We've talked to Impression 5 about this a little
bit.
We're hoping to get some kind of museum exhibit there.
Eric, were you involved in the previous launch? Because this is not the first weather balloon launch by the Comm Arts Department.
I was.
Okay.
I was. And it wasn't as successful as we're hoping this one would be.
You learned a lot the first time around, did we?
Absolutely.
What did you learn?
Well, that was both of our first experiences launching the balloon, so it kind of we kind of nailed down our process a little bit on what to do. We had no idea going into it. And me and the other shooter, Kirk, got a lot of experience, I mean, shooting this whole process. It was kind of like on the go the entire time.
And what kind of cameras do you use to shoot the behind-the-scenes thing?
Last time we were using a HMC 150 Panasonic, and now I will be using a DSLR.
Is that a movie camera?
Yeah, it's a
standard movie-type camera?
Yeah, it's a high-definition camera.
Yeah, they're television cameras. So yeah. So the students that are working with me are going through the MSU television program and the documentary film program. So they're shooting this just like any TV station would.
Tell us a little bit more about what went south the last time.
Well, you know, when Eric says it went south, you know, it just means it wasn't fully successful. I like to think of it as we were 2/3 successful instead of 1/3 of a failure. But we learned how to launch it. We knew that it flew. We knew that it came down under parachute, so the flight was successful. The only problem with it was we didn't get to recover it because it landed 2 miles into Lake Erie.
Okay.
So we had a little bit of a problem getting out there. But we kind of knew that it was going to travel in that direction from the flight path that the Weather Service told us that theirs took in the morning. But it was a test flight.
And that went from Grand Rapids all the way to Lake Erie?
This one we launched from Detroit.
Oh, okay.
So one of the lessons we learned was to launch from Grand Rapids.
Grand Rapids, <Yes. laughs> here we come.
Yes.
I can't get over how small these cameras are.
Yes.
The cameras that you're, the five of which are going to be in the balloon.
Yeah, they're all
a couple inches square.
Yeah, they're all HD cameras. These are the ones that the extreme sports guys use when they skydive and things like that. So we decided that was probably the best camera to use. I did some tests with this one. We had to buy the little extra battery backpack for the back so it can last about 3.5 hours worth of filming.
How big is the balloon?
Well, the balloon gets pretty big. It actually is about 8 feet when you blow it up, but as it rises, it gets bigger and bigger and bigger until it gets up to 100,000 feet, and there's a burst altitude for the balloon, and then the capsule will come down under a parachute.
How do you get? I mean, what do you use to get it up there? Is it
helium?
It's helium.
Yeah.
Okay. And why did you get involved with this? Why are you pursuing this particular opportunity, Eric?
Well, as a filmmaker, projects are kind of the thing to do. And Troy approached me about this project, and I was definitely intrigued.
You talk about telecommunications, media, and information. You don't expect to be getting involved in the weather balloon business.
Right.
That's what I find interesting about this whole thing. Plans for more launches. Do you see this as the second in a series of these kinds of things?
Yeah, I think so. This is the MSU space program, you know. And I went over and I talked with the engineering department. The engineering department has some interesting projects that they're working on where they have these little flyers that they're kind of like little helicopter blades that you can drop, and they go down really slowly, and they put sensors on them. So some of the engineering people talked to me, and they want to put some of these things in one of our weather balloons. So we have projects beyond this, and you know, it's always projects like this are a lot of fun, but you know, these cameras cost money. So at some point, we need to get funding for it.
When they end up in the drink,
yes.
Then you've got some explaining. You got to have some justification for the project.
Well, right. Well, luckily that was the first experiment, and we put pretty cheap cameras in that one.
Oh, good.
So these are a little bit more expensive this time.
You had some foresight the first time.
Well, I actually turned to these guys because we saw the path of the balloon, and I said, "Hey guys, should I take the expensive camera out of this one before we launch it?" They're like, "That might be a good idea."
Eric, were you interested in space as well growing up, or you see yourself as primarily a media guy who just happens to have gotten involved in this project involving space?
Growing up, yeah. I was definitely interested in space. I liked planes a lot growing up, but as I got older, like filmmaking and media is definitely where I'm supposed to be.
How many students have their hands on this project, Troy?
Oh, geez, we have probably 3 or 4 filmmaking students, and then we have some PhD.
You got some engineering students as well.
Yeah, well, two of the engineering students are coming with us on this launch because they're doing experiments for future launches. You know, they're putting together experimental packages to put on board future projects. So they want to see how this one goes, and they're going to help us build this one as well.
But are they curious about the aeronautics involved here, the balloon launch, or is there something... There's something else they want to learn from.
Well, a lot of that, and part of it is they're building those little flyers. And those flyers, they wanted, they're kind of doing one of those things like Twister, where they drop a whole bunch of things and they measure the weather systems and things like that.
Okay.
So they want to drop a couple on this flight just to see if they'll work. So for future flights, maybe we'll send up a balloon with one camera and a whole bunch of their little flyers.
When did you first get this idea, Troy? This is your baby, right?
Yeah.
Well, has this been percolating in the back of your mind for decades, or did this come to you more recently?
Well, more recently, but the nice thing about working at MSU is I get the opportunity to pretty much be as creative as I want to be and do whatever project I want to do. And the great thing for me is I get to bring students on board like Eric, and it's outside the classroom teaching. You know, these guys are going out and they're doing real filmmaking. Where I can give them an assignment in class, but it's not quite as much fun as, hey, let's go out and let's put a whole bunch of cameras in a balloon and let's see if they come back. You know, that's a little bit more of a like, oh yeah, that's cool, let's go do that. But the stuff that Eric's learning is the same stuff that they'll learn in class.
Troy Hale is a filmmaker and an MSU instructor in the College of Communication Arts and Sciences. Eric Tobler's an MSU student. They're two of a team that this Sunday will launch a weather balloon affixed with HD cameras to the edge of space. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Throughout Michigan's history, the state's African-American population is often portrayed as an urban population, but that depiction overlooks a part of Michigan's history. Many blacks settled in rural areas before and after the Civil War. In 1960, Cass County was home to over 1,500 blacks. Surprisingly, that's just under the number of African-Americans found in Wayne County at the time. Dr. Benjamin Wilson is an emeritus professor of history at Western Michigan University. He's the author of the book Black Eden, The Idlewild Community, and he's an expert on black rural history. Dr. Wilson sat down with current state's Emmanuel Berry, and as a precaution, he used some colorful language to explain to her why a native Floridian took interest in Michigan's rural African-American heritage.
First of all, I'm from Florida. I was born in Tampa, Florida, raised in Fort Lauderdale, and then my parents decided, since I was Catholic, they'd punish me and send me to an all-boys Catholic college in Kansas. But while I was living in Florida, I knew of three cities in Michigan. Detroit, because of Motown. Battle Creek, because I watched cartoons on Saturday morning. And the last city I knew of was a place called Lansing, because my uncle worked as a chemist at Oldsmobile. As a matter of fact, he was one of the first African-American chemists at Oldsmobile. And I always thought that Michigan was an urban state. Then while I was at Michigan State, I think it was like in 1970 or 71, while working on my doctorate, I took a course from one of the best teachers that Michigan State ever had, hell of a scholar by the name of Dr. Ruth Hamilton. Ruth taught a course called Rural Sociology. And about six of us took a ride from East Lansing, urban East Lansing, okay, and ended up in a place called Vandalia, which is in Cass County. Decidedly rural. And the first thought I had was Demopolis, Alabama, because, you know, here I am thinking that all black folk in Michigan were basically urban. As a matter of fact, a lot of sociologists, when they write pieces on blacks as if we were an urban people only. And so while driving through Vandalia, I began to see all these black folks say, what the hell are they doing here? And at that point, my interest was spurred. Like, why in the heck would anybody in their right mind would want to move to a rural area? In the process of doing my dissertation, I began to find out these strange numbers of black people living in places like Kalamazoo County, Cass County, Calhoun County, up north, Macosta. And I began to investigate other places in Michigan. So I just can't understand why these folks are moving here. And then during the pre-Civil War years, I checked out the Underground Railroad routes. And wherever there were Underground Railroad routes, there were always black populations there. Hold on. I'll go up and get this map so we can look at it.
Yeah. Okay.
All right. One of the first research papers I did for a history class in Michigan State
It was on the black presence in Ingham County before the Civil War.
What was it like?
Here's Ingham, 42 black people.
This is a map from 1860.
Yeah, 1860. All right, 42 black folks in Ingham County. Now, imagine this one brother up here in Antrim. But in cases like that, white folks made him an honorary white person because the number was so small. Look at Emmett County.
We've got 934
black people in Emmett County in 1860. As a matter of fact, they were there long enough to start a little village. It's now one of Michigan's registered black ghost towns. It's called Freedom. Now, in 1870, those brothers were gone.
Chicago,
Detroit, I don't know. I got the hell out of Dodge. But you notice, wherever you have these underground railroad routes, and there were six, according to Blanche Cogent, about six major routes in the Michigan area. Now, a lot of people attribute it to the Quaker presence, which is a bunch of crap, in my opinion.
Why is that?
It's because Quakers were no different than any other European American in the pre-Civil War years in Michigan. Everybody talk about how the Quakers helped slaves to escape. Bull. It was a symbiotic relationship. I'll help you if you help me. Well, now, imagine now, I'm a Quaker. Okay, not the radical Hicksite Quakers. Now, the radical Hicksite Quakers, but those were the Quakers who refused to eat or use any product associated with slave labor. And they were the ones who were actually involved in the Underground Railroad operation. However, it was still a symbiotic relationship. I knew Emmanuel was running away from slavery. I would help her, but I also have 40 acres that need clearing. Okay, in some cases, you see something developing like a runaway slave sharecropper kind of relationship. And coincidentally, in some cases, especially in southwestern Michigan, you had quite a few Hicksite Quakers living in the area. So that would explain the presence of a lot of these black folk here. In addition to it, these routes, these Underground Railroad routes that we see highlighted, there were tons of other routes. Tons of other routes. And you can understand why Michigan was so loaded with Underground Railroad routes, because right on the other side of the Detroit River is Canada.
Looking down at Cass County and looking over at Wayne County right now, mm-hmm. So we have, Cass has, you know, 1,500. And Wayne has 1,600, and I would never think that those would be as close as they are in number.
Oh, yeah. But the deal is, the reason why Cass is because of the, look how many routes that cross the county. In addition to it, you had a sizable Quaker population, and some of those Quakers, not all of them, were anti-slavery, and they believed in justice. Wayne County has that number because you're only a spit away from Canada. But Emmett, with 934, a lot of the slave catchers who were like bounty hunters, they were aware of Cass County, aware of Wayne County, because heck, in the 1840s, by 1850, we're talking about maybe three or four slave raids that occurred here with Kentuckians. We don't know how many occurred in Wayne County, but it wasn't unusual for slave catchers to just be lurking there, okay, for these areas, waiting for fugitives to show up. A lot of the brothers decided, I'll just keep going further up. I'll keep going further up. And some ended in Emmett County.
African Americans, what do they do in these communities? Are they farmers?
A lot of them, especially in southwestern Michigan, a lot of them were farm workers. They might find this one Hicksite Quaker who was cooler than the rest of the Quakers. And this individual would help this individual who started off as a farm worker acquire, you know, pay him a little cash, and eventually they would begin to purchase land. At one time, around the late 1860s, there was a guy by the name of Bill Allen. They called him Hog Bill. He paid more taxes than anybody in Cass County, and he was an African American. And of course, you know why they named him Hog, because he raised hogs. Okay, then you had a guy there in Cass County by the name of C.W. Bunn. C.W. Bunn eventually purchased land and became the owner of a sawmill. There was a guy by the name of Hawks. They called him the Hay King because he had accumulated land and started purchasing hay. I'm not growing hay. So they either worked as farm workers or farmers. Some of them, if they lived in close proximity to a big city like Kalamazoo, they would come to Kalamazoo and work a little bit and then go back home. But the majority of them were farm workers. As a matter of fact, At one time, up to 1920, I think southwestern Michigan had a large black large number of black farmers, and those black farmers, believe it or not, were growing blueberries. Now, we're not talking about black folks who own acres in excess of 120. We're talking about eventually folks would acquire 4 or 5 acres, cultivate it, and with the proceeds, if they make a profit, buy some more land, and then some more land, and then some more land. And of course, at this particular time, to save money, mom and dad, especially dad, made sure he had about 14, 15 kids, okay, because the kids would now be farm laborers. I remember I used to do that kind of stuff. Of course, I only came from a family of two. My father came from a family of 14, and my grandfather, Sumner, okay, had a little farm, and I thought we were always going there for summer vacations. Oh, hell no. Hell no.
You got put to work.
You got put to work. So we're talking about farm laborers, farmers, and in some cases, they were in the service industry, being domestics, okay, or being chauffeurs, we're talking about in the 1920s or so.
What happened to those communities? What happened to the communities of rural African Americans? And, you know, when you go up north, when I was a kid, we'd go up north, and my dad, if he saw another black person, there was, you know, first shock and then excitement for that moment. And you know, those communities aren't really there. What happened to these rural communities?
Just like throughout all of urban industrialized world, a lot of young kids are now being lured to the city. They leave the farm. And if you go back to the rural areas, you find basically the average age of people like 60 to 80 still on the farm. The young kids left, moved to the city. And as a result, you got that disconnect. And since there's no family that I have in the city, I join another family called a gang. You find that same phenomenon occurring in Cape Town, South Africa, in Johannesburg, South Africa, in Harare, Zimbabwe. When folks leave the rural area, usually where they were born, they leave the grandmothers, grandparents, and you go to that rural area of village and you see just elderly people. The young people move to the city. They move to the city because they think the city is where the opportunities are. So in some cases, you see the population of rural black communities dwindling because the young people are leaving.
When you look at African-American history and the lack of it being portrayed in mainstream history books or in mainstream in general, do you feel like it's important to write African-Americans into history?
Oh, hell yeah. But here's the deal. When you write us into history, don't write me in as a second hand. No, I don't want to be the supporting actor or actress. No person should be supporting actor or actress when you're writing history, because everybody who lives down here leave a historical dent. Sometimes, have you been in a class when people talk about great men and great? How the hell you know who's great or who's not great? Do you become a great man in history if your name is R.E. Olds? You know, they usually always write these history books about people who are wealthy as hell, treacherous as hell, inventors, common people. As a matter of fact, they've gotten to the point, they just called people the common man. I ain't no common man. My name is Ben Wilson. If you can write about R.E. Olds, write about him also, Ben Wilson, because he made a historical contribution down here also.
Why is it important to share this story of rural African American history for you?
Why is it important? I never thought of it. I never did. I just figured if you were interested in the lives of a group of people, you should go beyond the urban area, because the black experience is not only a urban experience, but it's also a rural experience. I mean, what the hell? A lot of the brothers who are now living in the cities came from someplace that was rural in the American South. Sometimes we can get so cityfied and urban and elite that we lose our connections with the South. You know what I'm talking about? So I figure that if you're going to talk about the African-American experience, I don't give a crap what time period, you got to realize that not every brother settled in the urban area.
Thank you so much for talking to me. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Oh, no problem at all. No problem at all.
Coming up tomorrow on Current State Weekend, host Emmanuel Berry discusses a paradigm shift in gardening, the native plant movement, and next week, the role Michigan played in the Battle of Gettysburg. That and more, all coming up on Current State. We hope you have a great weekend. I'm Mark Bayshore. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR.
Support for WKAR is provided by LSJ Media, offering digital marketing solutions to area businesses of all sizes, such as website development, email marketing, optimization, and more. Information at lsjmedia.com. And by the MSU Alumni Association, offering opportunities for networking, alumni enrichment, and community involvement with MSU alumni in your area and across the country. Alumni.msu.edu.